in community, we can survive it, I think. And we can honor those who don't survive it by talking about that instead of just, you know, oh, this is me, this is my story, this is my baby, this is some cutesy memorial I have for them, and that's the end of it.
It's connected to the whole collective grief, and we can have more empathy for others who have gone through great loss and hopefully do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Our TFMR stories, pregnancy loss support in the heartbreak of terminating a wanted pregnancy.
Welcome back to another episode of Our TFMR Stories. Today we have Liz with us. She lost her baby to Edwards syndrome, which is also trisomy 18. And she wanted to come on and tell her story of going through this pregnancy loss, which is also related to the whole abortion landscape and living in a state where it is unfortunately illegal. So thank you so much, Liz, for being here and for being willing to share your story with us. It really means so much.
Thank you for posting and for just creating the space for those of us who want to talk about it to get our stories out.
It's so important because sometimes it could feel like we're being silenced from all around. So in the pregnancy loss community, maybe they don't understand that this is also a type of pregnancy loss. And in the abortion advocacy or reproductive justice area, sometimes, you know, it's just called a fetus. It's just called a that. And the whole realm of the experience really isn't held. So in this space, we hold all parts of the story. I like to start these interviews by asking our guests to share their favorite memory from their pregnancy that they lost, because sometimes they can get lost in the tragedy of the ending and the horrors of the diagnosis and how it all has to go down. But these memories do exist. So what would you share as your favorite memory during your pregnancy?
Sure. I think it was definitely, so we are fortunate to have a living child, and he turned 2 over the summer, and his birthday party was the day after my 9-week appointment. I had a 7-week and I had a 9-week, which was different than when I was pregnant with him, actually. And it's related to the more restrictive laws that were passed in my state. We have a 12-week ban. And so they actually, some practices, including the one I went to, like kind of try to scoot you in for some appointments before that mark so they can diagnose before that 12-week. So after my 9-week, when we saw good growth, everything measuring correctly, perfect heartbeat, all that, I think I was feeling optimistic. With my son, I was very nervous. I almost didn't tell anyone until I was like beyond showing. Like I was telling people I was pregnant and they were like, yeah, we know. And this time around, I had relaxed a little bit. I told my parents. So at my son's birthday party, I told my parents, I told my in-laws. I was wearing some pregnancy shorts. I was drinking non-alcoholic beer, and like people were starting to pick up on it. And it was just a very fun day. Just, I remember thinking like, oh, maybe I shouldn't tell people at his party because I don't want to take away from him. And then I was like, oh no, like this is our family now. We're going to be a family of 4, and this is where we're going to have enough love for both children.
It sounds like a really beautiful family memory. Like this child is part of this family. This child is here taking part in their sibling's birthday party, and the rest of the family would be excited if we told them. Do we tell? Do we not?
Right. Yeah.
And then it wasn't so happy.
Yes.
Then what happened?
So I think at the 9-week, they had gone ahead and done my NIPT test. They can do them that early. And so at 11 weeks, I got a phone call and they said, hey, your blood work came back inconclusive. They didn't say why, but I think we just did it too early. Maybe we didn't quite, you know, get your conception date correct. And I'm thinking, no, I know it's correct because this was a planned pregnancy and I did all the things. So I know exactly the day. But they were like, you know, this is really normal. It happens all the time. You know, we'll just send somebody to your house to redraw the test. And so they redraw the test. I go in, I think for maybe a 12-week appointment, everything's looking great. And then at 13 weeks, I get that phone call that's like, okay, it came back inconclusive again. And this time you had a low fetal fraction. And they say, so now you are a high risk. You're considered high risk for T13 and T18. And I remember this conversation so clearly over the phone because I think it was a midwife who called me. She said, don't worry too much. You know, this happens a lot. It can be caught. It's not always because of a genetic issue. Sometimes it's just a fluke. Don't worry. Don't worry. We'll get you in to check you out next week. And I remember asking, I said, okay, well, how many times have you seen this? Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, a few times, but they all had normal babies. And I said, okay, no. But how big is the sample size? Was it 2? Was it less than 10? Was it 20? You know, I have a science degree. I want to know. And she's like, oh yeah, less than 10. And then I start doing my research and, you know, realizing that the things that could have triggered this didn't really apply to me. The one that was very vague was everyone's favorite BMI, right? That's still this like medical thing that's used. And they're saying, you know, a higher BMI can cause the NIPT to come back inconclusive. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, how high? Like, you know, so, and then people are saying, oh yeah, yours is probably high enough. That must be it. That must be it. And then I go in for my appointment the next week and the doctor's like, no. That's, what are you talking about? Like, that's for someone with a very high BMI. This is not you. I am concerned about this. We go back for an ultrasound. Everything's looking really good, but she goes ahead and gives me the MFM referral because she was concerned. She was concerned that, you know, I'd gotten this low fetal fraction with no obvious reason, you know, no twins, nothing like that. So.
And could we explain what the low fetal fraction is?
Sure. So this test is trying to draw from the birthing person's blood, which has some fetal DNA in it. Mm-hmm. But they have to have enough fetal DNA to run the test correctly. And so if there's not enough fetal DNA in the parent's bloodstream, then they can't do the test correctly. And that low percentage of fetal DNA is associated with the T18 and the T13.
So it's the fraction, the percentage of their little cells.
Yes, mixed in with mine.
In your blood. And it was low. And I'm sure you Googled.
Yes, I Googled. I Googled a lot. And
this can happen. And these inconclusive results do sometimes lead to a full diagnosis.
Yes.
In what cases?
Well, I mean, really a lot of them, it seems like. And that's the thing, is there wasn't great conclusive. I mean, I read every study about these that I could find.
I'm sure.
And yeah, a lot of them were like, oh, this is common in twins. This is common with the higher BMIs, but it's also often indicative of a genetic condition. And so, you know, I got I got that MFM appointment. And right around this time, we have a trip scheduled to the beach to celebrate my birthday and my sister-in-law's birthday, which are back to back. So we take the trip and, you know, we're there for 5 days and the whole time it's just like this gloomy cloud hanging over me, even though we're at the beach and it's sunny. Like, I just, you know, really trying to, you know, reassure me and don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's a fluke. It's going to be fine. You know, I'm visibly pregnant at this point and I'm already 13, 14 weeks and I'm already knowing that, hey, if we get this positive diagnosis, I am going to want to terminate. I had done my research and, you know, these were both conditions with really high mortality rates, including for T18, which is the one that it seemed like I probably had, the most likely outcome would have been a third trimester stillbirth. And I have a bleeding disorder. I'm already somebody who's at high risk for labor and delivery complications. So I already knew that would be my decision. We don't live in an area where there would have been high support anyway for a medically complex child, including one that was most likely going to die during their first year. Mm-hmm. anyway, I'm trying to figure out, can I do this in my state or not? And I posted anonymously in some parent groups.
Are there exceptions for health?
That's what I was trying to figure out. And they, you know, this was in August and they had just changed the law in July. So
it's all fuzzy.
It's all fuzzy. Nobody knows. Everybody is referring me to this collective of abortion doulas that supposedly are the best and they have all this knowledge and I just need to shoot them an email, leave them a voicemail. I did both of those things. Nobody responds. So I'm just, you know, kind of hanging out, not sure. We get back from our trip. We go to the MFM. That was also a really rough experience. I had had a dream two nights before where in the dream, we saw the nuchal transparency. Is that what it's called? Where they like measure that section behind the neck.
Yeah, I think NT for short.
Yeah. So I literally like dreamed this moment 2 days before it happened. And then, you know, we're doing the ultrasound tech and they get to that spot. Up until then, you know, we were maybe 10 minutes in with everything looking great and a spot, and the tech turns to the doctor and goes, do you want a measurement on this? And the doctor said, yes. And that was when my heart sank. I just knew. I was like, you know, I had seen it coming. So, you know, then the doctor leaves, comes back a few minutes later and she's like, yeah, you know, this is serious. You know, these are all markers for T18. There were a few of them. There was also heart defects. And some unusual growth in the feet, the club foot they could see.
Oh, sorry.
So, yeah, so there was that. There was the large nuchal transparency and then the heart defects. And I asked her, I said, have you ever seen a fetus with these things come out okay? And she said, no. And she said,
Not the answer that you want.
Yeah, no. She said, you have enough information to terminate, to go ahead and schedule a termination. If you want an amnio, we can schedule that, but you have to wait a little longer. So that now I'm having these choices. Now this time I did find out that because it was what's considered like a fatal fetal diagnosis, that I could do have a TFMR in my state. So that was a big relief. It sucked that it took 3 weeks for me to get that information, but getting that from the doctor was huge. So I was very relieved, but I also felt like I need this amnio for my own peace of mind. I want to protect myself and I want to protect the doctor who does my procedure in the event that this is ever questioned legally about whether I had enough information to go forward with it or not. So we wait a week, we go back a week later, and the ultrasound tech who's checking to see if my membrane wall is fully formed, which is usually kind of a prerequisite for the amnio, was very insensitive. She was saying things like, oh, look, there's the umbilical cord. That's where the baby's belly button is going to be. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, there's not going to be a belly button. I already have an abortion scheduled. And this is like this was on Monday and my abortion was scheduled that Friday. My doctor didn't want to wait because of the heightened risk that a spontaneous abortion would have caused me with my bleeding disorder. So she's like wanting to get this done, and I am too. And the tech says, okay, well, your membrane, so first the belly button comment, and then, okay, your membrane wall isn't fully formed, so we can just reschedule you to come back a week later. And I said, let me speak with the doctor.
Was it a lie? Were they lying?
They weren't lying, but she was just,
I always
like,
wonder,
living in la la land, like, yeah. I'm just having a normal pregnancy and we're just going to pretend like everything's fine until we get this DNA result. And I said, let me speak to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, the doctor was awesome. The doctor really went above and beyond, you know, apologized for the text comments, you know, affirmed that that was really inappropriate and that the tech is not supposed to make those types of comments, and encouraged me to submit a report about it, which I did. And then basically said, you know, actually, I can go ahead and do this with the incomplete wall because you already have all of this information about what a high risk pregnancy this is. She explained, you know, there's other risks because of this and that. But and she was kind of like, one of the biggest drawbacks is I might not be able to get it. I might not be able to get it without that kind of anchor point to put the needle through, but I'll do my best. And, you know, I thought about it for a minute. My partner was there. You know, he said, I support whatever you decide to do. And I said, no, let's try. Like, we came here to get this information. I want to at least try to get it. And so fortunately, we had a successful amnio. And two days later, I got that call confirming the diagnosis, and then went in the next day for my dilation, and then on Friday for the abortion. So I was really relieved that that doctor was willing to go ahead and try to get it for me, even though it wasn't all of the things they normally need to see to get that amnio. So I do feel like the care I got from her was really excellent, and I'm really grateful for that.
So much to go through when you're already devastated.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, it was like 5 weeks
the screening from
the first inconclusive test to the DNA result. And I think that's the thing that I never knew about fatal or gray fetal diagnoses, is that it's not just, oh, you go in for that anatomy scan and you get bad news that day. I know for some people that is how it goes, and I had read those stories, but I was not really aware that for most of us, it's this sort of bad news to worse news to the worst news kind of cascade of information that you're getting at all these appointments. I did not realize how many appointments it was going to take, and
it can be a long and how drawn exhausting. Out.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I've read process. Others who are, you know, it takes months and months, like, you know, because they just have to wait and see, okay, well, let's check in so many weeks and see how much worse it is, and or if it's better, you know, and it's really cruel how these timelines compete with the legal timelines, right? Of where you're trying to, you know, get all this information so you can make the best decision. And then you've got these cutoffs that are really rushing us or prohibiting us from being able to take the time we need to get the appointments we need, see the specialist, get a second opinion if we want it. It's not pro-life at all. You know, it's really the opposite. So, yeah.
No, it's not pro getting all of the medical information that you need to make a fully informed decision.
Yeah.
It is not pro-life. That is a misnomer of the ultimate caliber.
Yes.
So you had made your decision, and then you got the, do people call them fish?
I forget
what it stands for, but yeah, it's like the fast results.
Yeah, where they just check 13, 18, 21, X and Y. Yeah.
Was that what helped you make your final decision, or were there other elements?
It was a huge relief. I think I would have probably moved forward without the fish confirmation based on the physical issues that were present on the ultrasound and on the doctor telling me that I already had enough information between the low NIPT, the physical markers, and the membrane wall being behind schedule. Like, it should have been there by then and it wasn't. And she's like, yeah, that's kind of your third clue that something's really wrong here. So I think I would have gone ahead with it. But there's also the possibility that I would have said, no, I want to postpone this. And it would have been really hard, because it would have been really choosing between taking an increased risk for my own personal safety as somebody who's responsible for a living child. And even if you're not, like, we deserve to live. We deserve to not be risking our lives even more than carrying a pregnancy is inherently a risk. So I don't know. I don't know what I would have done. Fish result. It was a huge relief. It was a huge relief to get that back. So.
And then did you say that Friday you started the
Thursday? Thursday I went in for the dilation. I had somebody talk through with me that process, so I felt okay about it. I will say that the laminaria insertion for me was excruciating. It was on par with labor, and I mean, it didn't last nearly as long, but it was not just like a quick little inserting of a tampon that I had heard it compared to. It took maybe 10 minutes and was very painful, and then I was in a lot of pain for the rest of the day. It did give me muscle relaxers, so when I woke up the next morning I was feeling a little better, but honestly, like, the physical pain of that day of dilation was just so overwhelming that by the time it was time for, like, euthanasia and surgery, I was like, thank God, like, I'm just so ready to be done with this. I wasn't having like the visceral resistance to driving to the hospital or, you know, laying in the bed. And, you know, I was kind of, I feel like I was pretty detached from the feeling of, okay, after this, I'm just not going to be pregnant anymore and my baby's going to be gone. It was more like, this is excruciating and I just want the physical part to be done. Yeah. What I was telling people when they asked, like, oh, what does it feel like? Is it just some cramping? I was like, no, this is like the worst menstrual cramps plus a UTI plus constipation. That's what it feels like. So I will never sugarcoat that for anyone who wants to know what they might be in for. And I've read accounts where it wasn't that bad. So
yeah, but it sounds like you fell on the spectrum of very painful.
Yeah, I like to kind of prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And the flip side, the surgery day was great. It was very smooth. I really liked the doctor. She had given me her cell phone number the week before so I could like text her with any questions or any issues checking in or anything like that. So that was really great. We chose to have my fetal remains cremated, and the hospital like sent them to the cremation place we had picked out. So yeah. And then the weekend after, I did have like a lot of support. My mom was in town. I had some friends, you know, drop off like donuts and stuff. And I was just like in bed watching TV. I remember my discharge paperwork said like, oh, most women return to work a day or two later. And I'm like, what are they talking about? Like, physically, I needed, I think.
No, that is so wrong. I'm sorry. Even if it's like a 6 or 7 week abortion, that is so wrong.
No, I know. physically, I needed, I think, a full 5 days before I was back to like cooking or doing anything like that. And then, I mean, you know, emotionally, there's no limit on need to take a break from work. So fortunately,
that paperwork is medically dangerous.
It is. It is, because it's like, okay, I work for my partner. Thank goodness. So I was able to take as much time as I needed, basically. Although he did ask me right before they gave me the euthanasia if I had run payroll. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? He's like, hey, you ran payroll. Can we not? But yeah, afterwards, he was really, really great. And, you know, just took over all of my stuff for a while I recovered.
Yeah.
But but for people who have, you know, jobs that are not able to accommodate, I remember seeing that on the paperwork and being like, this is absurd. This is definitely, you know, you do go through postpartum, and having done that prior with my living child, I do feel like I was at least prepared for that, for the hormone crash, for the potential for lactation, for the bleeding. But I feel so strongly for people who go through this and are not mentally or physically prepared for postpartum. And because it's just an abortion, they aren't. I mean, we already do such a shit job of preparing parents for postpartum, even with a full term pregnancy. And I think for abortion, we have to do better. We have to do better for acknowledging that this person is still postpartum and they need that level of postpartum care that somebody with a living baby receives, or with a living baby should receive.
Yeah. Well, I've heard either the 3-3-3 rule or 5-5-5 rule. So 5 days in bed, 5 days around bed, and 5 days near, like being able to get in bed whenever you need it. We need all that time for our body to recover.
Yes. Yes.
And absolutely. That's just the beginning, you know, that's still only 15 days. It's
yes. Yes.
And then beyond immediate postpartum, and how was your recovery and with grief and emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, if you'd like to share?
Sure. Well, I feel like I'm still in that. I'm still in recovery. I'm still in grief. It definitely feels like, you know, it's not linear at all. I think I went through a period of just feeling really kind of numb about things, definitely feeling very sad sometimes. It's hard. It's both a blessing and hard to be parenting a living child after this. On the one hand, it's infinitely fortunate to already have a living child and to not have that secondary grief of wondering, will I ever be a parent in a way that's recognized? Will I ever get to parent the way I had planned in my head, right? Like, you know, I know that's what others go through. And at the same time, a living toddler is extraordinarily demanding. You know, I'm not able to just sleep whenever I want, or shut down and watch a silly show whenever I want, or wake up when I want. So there, it's definitely, I feel like the processing time gets dragged out a little bit because I just have very little free time to really devote to it. There's a bereaved mom who sells these little like weaving kits, which are really cool. Her name's Ashton Zager. I think she would love any followers from Lost Moms, Lost Parents. And I got one. I actually had it from years ago, but I started getting it out and being like, okay, this like weaving time is going to be like my grief processing time. And I, you know, I've worked on it like three times. So I wanted to have it done by my due date, which of course didn't happen. And like between myself and another bereaved mom, you know, I have this like very dark humor aspect to it. And I'm just like, oh yeah, well, it doesn't matter if it's late for a baby that's never coming. Like, aww. You know, I can work on it forever. You know, there's no deadline on me finishing it. So,
And isn't that grief, you know,
yeah.
It takes the time that it's going to take, mm-hmm. and it's longer than we think it's going to be. And
yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking about your timeline. You're just about 5 months out, really, only.
Yeah. Yeah. My due date just passed this month. Mm. So, and it was definitely a hard day. I just gave the toddler unlimited screen time. I was just like, you know what? You're just going to get to do what you want to do. And yeah. I'm going to do what I want to do, which was just cry and look through my photo album, my memory box, you know, talk to some other bereaved parents and just kind of feel like shit. That's what I did. And the next day I kind of picked up a little bit and just, you know, it's like, it's not somehow better that date passed, because now instead of thinking, oh, I should be pregnant right now, it's, oh, I should have a little baby right now.
Reaching that point changes that.
Right. That feeling of, and you know, that's how it is for the rest of our lives. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, I should have a 4-year-old now. I should have a 6-year-old mm-hmm. now. I should have a high school graduate now. I should, yeah. you know, be watching my child figure out their adult life right now. Like, I know that's how it's going to be forever. So I think that's where the overwhelm can really get to me sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like never ending, and it can be hard to think of taking on decades of grief.
Right. Yeah. So I definitely try to just, you know, do it one day at a time. And
yeah,
you know, I'm very fortunate to have a handful of friends who are very available for the grief talk. One of them in particular lost a 7-week-old baby, and this was 6 years ago. I know I didn't even know this about her until I started kind of telling her about what I was going through, and then she shared her story with me, and ever since then she's just been incredible. I mean, just 24/7 available for whatever. One of the things she said to me that I will always tell people to tell their bereaved friends is, she said something like, I have had all of the thoughts and feelings associated with this grief that are possible, and they are all safe with me. I've had all of them. And so, you know, never feel like whatever you're feeling is too dark or scary to get out, because yeah. it's not.
Yeah. And those are exactly the thoughts and feelings and emotions that need to be held.
Yes. And I feel like just so grateful to have somebody who said that to me early on. I know a lot of people don't get that. And that's what I want as we put these conversations out there.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't bring tissues. I was like, I'm not going to need tissues for this. I talk about this all the time.
Oh,
but.
Today's episode is sponsored by our Ascend TFMR Grief Circle Program. In the Ascend Program for TFMR, termination for medical reasons, ending a wanted pregnancy, we see you. We see your motherhood, parenthood, fatherhood. We see your heartbreaking decision. We see your babies. We honor your grief.
And when we come together to do this work, there is a community aspect of healing that is so desperately needed. I created this program because when I went looking for something like this after my own TFMR in 2018 and did not find anything, this was the space that I created for us, a place to be held, a place to write, to art, to speak, a place to transmute, to care, to share, to really honor ourselves and our babies. The next groups are starting in early May 2024. You'll find the link to learn more in the description, or you can go to thetfmrdoula.com/ascend-apply. And also during this time frame, there's been everything going on in Palestine with the genocide and this collective grief that we're also going through. I know you wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, I was telling you that, you know, when October rolled around, I started posting about my TFMR and thinking, okay, this is going to be some time for me to really get some things off my chest, you know, just how I'm feeling in my grief, how I'm feeling about the politicization of abortion, how I'm feeling about the ways in which mainstream abortion spaces are not designed to support TFMR parents. And then I should have followed up on this, that abortion doula collective emailed me back 3 weeks later and said, sorry, there are no medical exceptions in your state. You will have to travel. Here are some recommendations. So too late. I already had my abortion by the time they got back to me. But two, they were dead wrong. They were completely wrong. There were a couple of medical exceptions and my condition qualified and I did not have to travel. And so, yeah, that was a whole thing where another friend of mine who was just awesome wrote them a very long email where they attached highlighted sections of the entire legislation showing where the exceptions were and were basically like, if y'all want to advise people on this, you need to read this stuff. So that was really great that my friend did that all for me. But yeah, so back to October, you know, then we have just this huge escalation in that region. And suddenly my social media feeds are just filled with death and grief from, you know, families, parents who all deserve better, all deserve safety for themselves, their children, their family. And I feel like as a bereaved parent, I was already kind of just like broken open. So all of it hit me really hard. I mean, I do think I kind of like spent the rest of 2023 just in this very deep depression. I wasn't really, kind of just like going through the motions, but not really myself. I also just felt like I have no choice but to engage with this because I'm sitting here from a position of such privilege where I was able to experience my loss and then return to a life of safety and stability, you know, relative. And I'm over here watching all these families who have no sense of either of those things after losing one, but many times more family members, more children. And there's no end in sight for these families who are either, you know, waiting on information about the status or safety of somebody, waiting to get a body back, waiting to have consistent food available, housing, you know, so many people displaced over this. So it's just, there's a quote in a book I read, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but it talks about like in Buddhist philosophy, how there's like this idea of like a soft spot inside of all of us. And that when it is activated, we feel everyone's pain as our own. And, it, you know, it's not to appropriate anybody's experience of trauma and war that I can't possibly actually relate to, but it's just to recognize that if we lean into our own grief, that we can actually really be in touch with that in a way that moves us to be courageous and speak up and take action and actually think about like every day, what choices can I make that support these other people in the world who are also in so much pain that I'm not experiencing my grief journey as in isolation. at all. It's the opposite. And like that, the things that supposedly separate us are really these like constructs, right? They're not as real as we want them to be. And so I'm very much about, in my grief, just kind of tearing down those perceived walls between myself and anyone else who is in this kind of pain right now, and trying to just hold that reality better. And in community, we can survive it, I think. And we can honor those who don't survive it by talking about that instead of just, you know, oh, this is me, this is my story, this is my baby, this is some cutesy memorial I have for them, and that's the end of it.
It's not connected to the whole collective grief, and we can have more empathy for others who have gone through great loss and hopefully do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is hard, because if you're in like your massive early grief, it's harder to do outward big expressions, but there can be smaller things that we can even do in solidarity.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think like for me, it's just that I'm not into silver linings. I'm not into, you know, oh, well, at least there's this, or at least I grew in this way, or at least I, you know, there's no at least. It's like, no, it just sucks. But if I think back on, okay, what do I wish I had known before, or how has this changed me? I mean, there's really something that's cracked open in me about really seeing others.
Mm-hmm. And the deep connection to all of our humanity and these systems of oppression. And going through TFMR specifically, we start to feel that, right? We come up against these oppressive laws, and then we see, well, we've been seeing, you know, what's going on in Palestine, and we see, oh, okay, there's oppression everywhere.
Right. And what does it look like to really be pro safety for birthing people, pro choice, pro whatever we want to call it? I mean, pregnant people deserve safety, deserve healthcare, deserve futures with their babies, and grieving people deserve safety and space to grieve and to have their basic needs met while we grieve. Mm-hmm. And that's just very, very fundamental for me right now.
Oh, yeah. And you really realize that grieving is a privilege.
Yes. Yes.
And at the same time, it's pathologized.
Right.
Like, you should be better already. You should be over it. Or like, stop watching the news so much. Or like, don't worry about that. Like, that's not happening here. That's pathologizing grief. Because when we're feeling the grief, the collective grief, or our individual grief, that's the true humanity.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's no space for it in our current systems. We have to make the space ourselves. We have to talk about our stories. And then our grief can become revolutionary. So even coming on and sharing your story today.
And I do see, you know, so many TFMR folks who have been kind of radicalized by their experience. And I'm so supportive of that. And I wish we wouldn't wait for it to happen to us, any of it, you know, whether it's needing an abortion or needing safety in your home or whatever. Like, can we just not wait until it's affecting us personally to care? Because if we could push through that, then we'd have a better world.
I know. And I'll admit that, that was me as well for reproductive justice. Unfortunately, it took going through it myself to then be outwardly speaking about it and sharing about it and really seeing this as a huge issue.
Yeah, well,
and that comes from my place of privilege. And I hate that it's that way.
Yeah, and that's super real. And I think for me too, there's some levels to that, right? Like, I definitely used to be one of those people who would say, oh, well, abortion's fine because it's just a clump of cells. Or things like, oh, well, even if the laws change, we can still, you know, mail people pills, and we can still do all these things for people, with this assumption that like, oh yeah, it's always going to get caught early because it's always going to be unwanted pregnancies, quote unquote, that are experiencing abortion. There's a Brazilian filmmaker who made a film about her own TFMR. It's called Incompatible with Life, and it's only been like screened in some very specific spaces, and I've been trying to figure out how I can watch it. But one of the points that she makes that I saw like in the preview for it was about how like her own TFMR made her realize that like everyone who chooses an abortion is doing so because that pregnancy is incompatible with their life in some way. And that was really impactful for me to realize, like, yeah, we are all having adjacent experiences, even if they're not exactly the same.
You know, what I realized was that every single abortion decision is made with love.
Yes, absolutely.
And it becomes internal. There was internalized abortion stigma and hatred that I had inside of myself. And I would think, oh, they just didn't want their babies, and like, end of thoughts. But no, they couldn't have those children. And they love that potential life so much that they say, no, not in these circumstances.
Yes.
And it was the same sort of decision for me. I love this potential child so much that I say, no, not under these physical conditions, and not my body, and not with our broken systems of medical care that they would or wouldn't get if they were born alive. I said no, because of love.
Yeah. And that's why I'm so specific about using the word abortion to talk about my experience. And I know that's not true for everyone. It doesn't universally resonate with TFMR parents based on, you know, all of our unique circumstances and beliefs. But I do want the space to be able to recognize that that is the medical term for what I chose. And it's a neutral word. And it doesn't need to be criminalized or demonized or have any of these huge associations with it. And that's why I say it out loud as much as I can, because I want to reduce that reactivity that it has for so many people, and for us to move past the pregnancy loss abortion binary, right? Because that's so fake. You know, even friends I have who have chosen abortion because it was unplanned and they weren't prepared still experience many times very impactful, invasive grief. And when we start to realize how much we have in common, that's where we're a lot stronger and able to have more robust support networks for people that are more accommodating and more able to acknowledge the different unique experiences that we all have.
Mm-hmm. The human side of the experience.
Yeah.
What's something that you would share with someone who maybe is just going through their diagnosis, deciding, or very early out with their pregnancy loss?
I think one of the biggest things is just that you can sleep at night with your decision. Like, whatever the factors were that led to it, like, I just want to give permission for that to people. That's not something I personally struggled with a ton, because it was a fairly conclusive diagnosis and a diagnosis with very poor outcomes. But I know there's just such a range of, you know, especially with these legal timelines and people having to make a decision before they have all the information they want. And I just, you know, we've discussed some in your group about like the what ifs, and like, that's one that if I could just like let everyone off the hook on it with a magic wand, I would. Like, sleep at night with your decision. You made the best decision you could with the information you had at the time, and just that you're not a horrible person, and that if you don't have people in your life who are 100% on board and supportive of you, then come find us, because we're here and we will be that person for you. Everybody deserves to have that friend group, that support network. And if you're listening because you don't have that with your family members or your partner or your social scene, like, please reach out to Sabrina and come find the rest of us, because we really want to support you.
We really, really do. Yeah. The way that you can join our Facebook group is on my website. I'll put the links here. It's at the tfmrdoula.com/Facebook group, all one word. And we have an application process to keep us all safe because of all these things that we've been talking about here. But everyone who's in the group has had a TFMR. There are no like onlookers. There are no therapists or professionals who are just there trying to learn from our experience. No, this space is for us, for people who have gone through it, who have had this lived experience. And so we really get it. Unfortunately, people say, you know, the shittiest club with the best members.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would say definitely check that out. And if you would like some higher support, I also have one-on-one support. All of that is on my website at the tfmrdoula.com. And I have quarterly grief circles too, where we meet five or six of us and we stay together for about 3 months and we meet on Zoom every couple weeks. So those grief circles are really amazing too. I've started a pregnancy after TFMR monthly circle too, if you're in that part of your journey after TFMR. And if that goes well, maybe I'll start a trying to conceive, or maybe just a general monthly space, because when we come together and we talk about these things, that's what we desperately need, because these laws, they're trying to silence us. Do you feel that way, Liz?
Yeah, it definitely feels like they're trying to take our options away. Mm-hmm. They're trying to make us afraid to talk about it.
Yeah. And that harms the grief process.
Yeah.
I mean, they're taking away those grieving privileges.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, no one should have to lose a baby and then go to court. Like there should be no,
or be under in jail.
No circumstance.
Or be in jail.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, you shouldn't even have to leave your state to get care. I mean, that was such a huge fear of mine. And I feel so privileged that I was in that little exempt category. But now that's one of my hugest anxieties with trying to conceive again in the future is like, okay, what if, you know, we are extremely unlucky and get a repeat trisomy? And what if it's one of the ones that's not exempt? Or what if the laws have changed by the time I'm pregnant again? Or, you know, whatever. That's,
and they can.
So it's so anxiety inducing, and it's so dehumanizing to live with that over our heads and try to do something as joyful as growing a family with that type of stress. It's really messed up.
Mm. And that's the whole point of it. They're trying to stress us out so that we're unhealthy, so that we're more easily manipulated, more easily controlled, living under fear. But we don't have to choose that.
No,
you did nothing wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I hope that everyone listening can really hear that message today. So anything you would like to add?
I think we covered it all, Sabrina. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm so grateful for this opportunity to talk with you.
Oh, thank you so much. If you're watching this or you're listening on whatever podcast format you use, make sure to subscribe, like, I don't know, share all the things. It really, really makes a difference, because our stories are being silenced. And so the more that we can get them out, the better. Thank you so much.